Last week, we began the story of Bilam and Balak, and a story that takes three full chapters of Numbers, 22, 23, 24, to tell it. It's a long story. And we see from its timing, its structure, and its style that it almost certainly is an embellished account of an actual happening. An account of a very real event that gains somehow or another a kind of a legend status among the Hebrews. And it's all intended to get across to us some very important theological principles. Now, I want to say that when, I want to be clear that when I say embellished, this is not a fairy tale. This isn't born from somebody's imagination. But it does have elements added to it that makes the telling of the story memorable, and so it's much more easy to transmit from mouth to ear. We might say that it's developed what we would call a folk theme over time. The thing we have to keep in mind is that only in two places in the Bible do animals ever receive a voice: the serpent in Genesis and the donkey in Numbers. And these two figures couldn't be more different in their fundamental nature. The serpent was Satan himself and was no ordinary creature, no run-of-the-mill snake that had become possessed by evil. Rather, it is made clear that this serpent of Genesis was a completely unique being. No creature of the field was like him. Balaam's donkey, on the other hand, had no spiritual connection or status. He wasn't the product of some special divine creation. It was simply a common donkey that is said to have spoken, and Balaam didn't really seem all that impressed or surprised by it. He just talked to it. Makes me think of Shrek. Now, I maintain that this is one of the key elements of the story that helps us to recognize that over time, the actual historical events involving Balaam and Balak had become exaggerated and eventually succumbed to the standard Middle Eastern theme of talking animals. That's commonly used in their tales and in their traditions. In other words, this is a type, another type of the many types of literary devices employed in the Bible, but one that we are to recognize as theologically based Hebrew fable, just like Hebrews do. When I'm telling you about the nature of the story, while it might kind of be bothering you, it's not even controversial. Ancient and modern Bible scholars are in general agreement with what I just told you. Now, in this narrative, Balak is the current king of Moab. Balaam is this Gentile diviner, a prophet, who lives in western Mesopotamia, in a place that is right on the border between modern-day Syria and Turkey along the mighty Euphrates River. King Balak has 3 million Israelites on his doorstep. And he's a little worried that his army is not going to be able to defend his kingdom from him. So Balak does a very usual and normal thing for that era. He hires a professional sorcerer to help him out. And the key to victory, at least Balak believes this, is to get the gods to side with him and to fight against Israel. In biblical terms, Balak wants to have somebody put a curse on Israel so that they can be defeated. The king's choice to curse Israel for him is a well-known seer named Balaam. He's a gun for hire. Now, while this story is less historic and more Hebrew fable in its style, the amount of theology in the prophecy it contains is astonishing. And as we're going to see, it has wondrous messianic overtones to it that are undeniable. Now, perhaps the foremost principle that we first uncovered in our last lesson was this, and it's a really important one. Being inspired of God to prophesy for him does not mean that the person who does it has a righteous standing with God. God has used pagan kings, pagan prophets to achieve his will in the past, and he will again. Yehovah has made direct contact with heathens. He's instructed them to say or do something, and many of them have obeyed it. Yet they are not redeemed, nor have they been declared to have right standing with Yehovah. What this means is that a man who is a false prophet can at times be accurate. In an earlier class, we just read from Matthew 24 that Christ said, look, there's going to become false prophets and false messiahs that are going to do tremendous miracles before you. And they're going to be real, but they're not from God. He can, a false prophet, at times be given a vision of the future by God himself, but that's in order that the Lord achieves some inscrutable purpose only known to him. In some ways, this makes it all the more difficult for a believer to judge just who's a man of God versus a man who walks apart from God, yet outwardly seems to be in fellowship with him. I mean, I wish I could give you a nice checklist of how you can make that determination, but I'm in the same boat with you. And this means that I and you, we need to study all of God's Word to be able to recognize God's pure ways versus all the other ways that only mimic his ways to some degree. And in order that we can recognize his divinely authorized patterns versus doctrines of men that trade in the patterns for buzzwords. Maybe I ought to say buzzards. Or things that just give us nice warm feelings. Now remember, we're told that Satan, who is the essence of pure evil, can disguise himself as what? An angel of light. Therefore, a person can be so deceived that they honestly believe that God anoints them, when in fact they're being used as a counterfeit tool by the evil one. Or more likely, they probably just followed their own evil inclination, blaming it on the devil. So just because a person says all the right things and claims to be speaking for the Lord, don't just assume that he or she is. Here's the test. The one test we have for a person who claims to be a prophet of God. If they're ever wrong, they're not. Ever. And when I use a prophet in this sense, I mean someone who's predicting an event that hasn't happened yet. They're foretelling the future. A prophet, in this sense, is all someone who says, well, the Lord came to me and gave me a word for you. Today, and at times in the New Testament, the term prophet is actually used in the sense of just meaning a teacher of Holy Scripture. And believe me, anyone who teaches is going to make mistakes from time to time. You're looking at them. But the biblical prophet, the Old Testament type of prophet, is a seer. He is one who's in right standing with the Lord. He is one who sees because he's been given a message directly from God. Therefore, the message cannot possibly be an error. And so let's continue our story of Balaam and Balak by rereading a portion of Numbers 22. Open up your Bibles to Numbers 22. We're going to read verses 9 through 35. 175 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. God came to Balaam and said, who are these men with you? And Balaam said to God, Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent me this message. The people who came out of Egypt have spread over the land. Now come and curse them for me. Maybe I'll be able to fight against them and drive them out. And God answered Balaam, you are not to go with them. You're not to curse the people because they're blessed. Balaam got up in the morning and said to the princes of Balak, return to your own land because Adonai refuses to give me permission to go with you. The princes of Moab got up and returned to Balak and said, Balaam refuses to come with us. But Balak again sent princes, more of them, higher status than the first group. And they went to Balaam and said to him, here's what Balak the son of Zippor says. Please, don't let anything keep you from coming to me. I'll reward you very well. Whatever you say to me, I'll do. So please come and curse this people for me. And Balaam answered the servants of Balak, even if Balak were to give me his palace filled with silver and gold, I can't go beyond the word of Adonai, my God, to do anything great or small. Now, please, you two stay here tonight so that I might find out what else Adonai will say to me. God came to Balaam during the night and said to him, if the men have come to summon you, get up and go with them, but do only what I tell you. So Balaam got up in the morning. He saddled his donkey and went with the princes of Moab. But God's anger flared up because he went. And the angel of Adonai stationed himself on the path to bar his way. He was riding on his donkey. Two servants were with him. The donkey saw the angel of Adonai standing on the road, drawn sword in hand, so the donkey turned off the road into the field. And Balaam had to beat the donkey to get it back onto the road. Then the angel of Adonai stood on the road where it became narrow as it passed among the vineyards and had stone walls on both sides. The donkey saw the angel of Adonai and pushed up against the wall, crushing Balaam's foot against the wall, so he beat it again. And the angel of Adonai moved ahead, and he stood in place so tight there wasn't any room to turn right or left. Again the donkey saw the angel of Adonai and lay down under Balaam, which made him so angry that he hit the donkey with his stick. But Adonai enabled the donkey to speak and said to Balaam, what have I done to you to make you beat me these three times? And Balaam said to the donkey, it's because you've been making a fool of me. I wish I had a sword in my hand. I'd kill you on the spot. And the donkey said to Balaam, I'm your donkey, right? You've ridden me all your life, right? Have I ever treated you like this before? No, he admitted. Then Adonai opened Balaam's eyes so that he could see the angel of Adonai standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, and he bowed his head and fell on his face. And the angel of Adonai said to him, why did you hit your donkey three times like that? I have come out here to bar your way because you're rushing to oppose me. The donkey saw me. He turned aside these three times. And indeed, if she hadn't turned away from me, I'd have killed you by now and saved it alive. And Balaam said to the angel of Adonai, I have sinned. I didn't know that you were standing on the road to block me. Now, therefore, if what I'm doing displeases you, I'll go back. But the angel of Adonai said to Balaam, no, go on with the men, but you're only to say what I tell you to say. So Balaam went along with the princes of Balak. In typical Hebrew storytelling fashion, verse 9 has Yehovah asking Balaam, the gentle diviner, a rhetorical question. Who are these men with you, and what did they ask you to do? Now, God, of course, knows what's going on here, but he establishes a direct dialogue between the Gentile seer, Balaam, and the God of the Hebrews. Three times in the Bible does God appear to non-Hebrews to warn them off from doing what they intended to do to his chosen people. All three times this is recorded in the Torah. The first is with King Abimelech when he was going to take Abraham's wife, Sarah, for his harem. The second was with Jacob's uncle on his mother's side, Laban, who, like Balaam, is a Mesopotamian, who was heading up a posse pursuing Jacob and his family because they were fleeing Laban's control. Balaam truthfully recounts what has been transpiring in the past few days of his life, and it is that these men had come to him, asking him to come with them to curse an army of people that had just come out of Egypt. And the ultimate purpose of the curse was so that King Balak could defeat these foreigners who vastly outnumbered his army. But Yehovah countermands the king of Moab's intention by telling Balaam he cannot curse this people, Israel. And you know why? It's too late. They're already blessed. Now, what exactly does that mean? They can't be cursed because they're already blessed. See, this is referring back to Genesis. It's referring to the covenant the Lord made with Abraham that was handed off to Isaac and then finally passed off to Jacob, called Israel. This covenant is always termed a blessing. And the Lord is in essence saying, It's utterly impossible to curse that which has been blessed from a spiritual sense. In other words, no one can reverse what Jehovah has determined. And from an earthly physical sense, to curse God's people by means of attempting to impede or harm his blessed people will bring divine retribution upon the one who's attempting to do the cursing. So God gives some advice. Don't do it. And even though Balaam's thought was that he'd go with these men, perform a bunch of mumbo jumbo, pronounce a curse upon the Israelites, and then go home with a pile of money for his efforts, Balaam was never going to hang around and be part of the battle. Balaam, as far as we know, wasn't even a violent man. Balaam had no intention of persecuting the Israelites or doing any personal harm to them. Balaam had been asked to intervene by a king who presented a good story and a much better promise of money. And by the morality of that day, Balaam would do what he was asked and then just kind of wipe his hands clean of it. Because after all, he was just a mercenary. He wasn't pro-Moab. He wasn't pro-Israel. Not personally, anyway. He had no dog in this fight. He had no real interest in the outcome. He was only doing his job as a professional diviner. He had no personal agenda, or as he saw it, he had no evil intent. Balaam was trying to be morally neutral, kind of like the UN. The problem is that to God there is no such thing as moral neutrality. That condition is a figment of our imaginations. Further, whatever one does to impede or harm God's people is an offense to God. I don't care what role we might play in it. For the Lord, a person is either for or against. As Yeshua said, you're either with me or you're against me. There's no middle ground. There's no moral Switzerland. So it is with cursing Israel. To not acknowledge Israel's untouchable blessing is identical in God's eyes to actively cursing Israel. Balaam can't just do his job for Balak and then disappear and absolve himself from all responsibility. Being a spiritual man, being aware that he had most definitely encountered a God, Balaam tells the delegation sent by Balak that he can't go with them because, as I quote, Jehovah won't let me go with you. That's right. Even though most of our Bibles will say, the Lord won't let me go with you, something like that, the original Hebrew employs God's actual formal name. Balaam, a gentle sorcerer, knew God's personal formal name. But understand, for Balaam, this didn't mean that Jehovah was his only God, or his family God, or the only God in existence. It's just that this particular God, who was at least one of the gods that had an interest in the Hebrews, had made it quite clear to Balaam that he had what he must do, what he must not do, and that really was good enough for him. He didn't want to know anymore. But just because of one rebuff, neither men with evil intentions nor Satan with his temptations give up and go away, never to bother God's people again. So when King Balak gets the word that Balaam says no to his offer, what does he do? He tries again. Takes a little different approach. And this time, he sends personal representatives of higher status than the ones he sent before, and he sends more of them to try and persuade Balaam to come around. And they tell Balaam that they'll increase the monetary offer. Balaam explains this isn't a matter of money. He's not saying no to get a higher fee. Then as the story builds up in tension, we find in verse 18, Balaam explaining that he is fully under the command of, and again, in the original Hebrew, Yehovah my Elohim. Well, anyone hearing this story or reading it and studying it like we are now would probably conclude that Balaam was a God-fearer. He held some kind of allegiance to Jehovah. But as the story confirms, and in other books of the Bible where more details are added to this, we find out that Balaam is simply a spiritualist. Certainly, he believes in Yahweh just like he believes in some number of other gods. In fact, Balaam was kind of boasting here. He was trying to impress this delegation of high government officials from Moab with his intimacy, with his influence in the invisible realm of the gods, and particularly with this god that most concerned Balak's immediate problem, the god of the Israelites. Balaam was a really good salesman. Now, being a good salesman was not just, it was important not just with his customers, but with the gods that he dealt with in his profession. So in verse 19, Balaam, who really wants this gig, and he really wants all that money that's going to go with it, tells the second group of men that come to him to stay the night because he's going to consult with God about this again. And he says, let me find out what else the Lord has to say about this. See, Balaam is used to bargaining. He is used to having gods change their minds. Why would this God be any different? In fact, this whole procedure of negotiating with the gods is the basis of divining. Negotiations with the god in question continues until the hoped-for omen is received. The diviner's motto was, if at first you don't succeed, try again. Now notice also that while in the first part of this story, the Lord came to Balaam unexpectedly and in some manner in which Balaam was fully awake, he was conscious, now Balaam is going to try to summon God in the more usual manner of diviners, a dream, an unconscious vision. Interestingly, Yahweh doesn't disappoint. Now, I want to point out that generally speaking, receiving something from the Lord in a dream was considered an inferior method of divine inspiration as compared to what the Lord's appointed prophets experienced. It's not that a dream was something to be looked down upon, but it paled in comparison to the type of ecstatic and fully conscious contact that God's prophets experienced, and there were precious few of those kinds of prophets. As far as we know, the Bible tells us the full extent of those who were God's prophets. This is why I pointed out earlier that the title of prophet can be applied in two very different ways, on two very different levels of intimacy with God. The prophet who is chosen to be God's personal mouthpiece over an extended period of time, bringing forth a direct and a new oracle from God. And the second type is more along the New Testament lines of someone who teaches God's word and to a degree interprets it or provides commentary on what's already been written by other writers. Loosely speaking, what this kind of prophet more closely resembles is what we would call today a teacher. Now, verse 20 says that indeed God came to Balaam in a dream, and he tells him that now it's okay to go with this contingent of men from Moab if they ask him to. But we quickly find that God is not pleased that Balaam wants to go to Balak. And here we have a clear example of God operating within men's free will. Balaam was determined to go. Balaam was a diviner who only knew the way of all diviners. And that meant negotiating with the particular god till you got what you wanted. And I want to think this through. Why was Balaam going to Balak despite the Lord insisting that Balaam was not to do what it was that Balak was hiring him to do? I mean, are we to take it that Balaam simply wanted to personally deliver the bad news to Balak that he just wasn't going to curse Israel for him? That Balaam would travel more than a couple of hundred miles walking and at times riding on the back of that donkey just to go home empty-handed because he wouldn't accept a job? Is that what he was doing? Hardly. Balaam just wasn't through negotiating with God. After all, Balaam had now received permission from Yehovah to at least go to Balak. Certainly the next step would be the Lord allowing Balaam some leeway concerning the cursing of Israel. Now, don't we sometimes kind of do that? We know full well the Lord's will is that we do or not do something, but we go ahead with our plan anyway. We inherently know that Yehovah's not going to probably strike us dead in the middle of whatever it is we're doing. And often we are no worse for the wear and achieve whatever it was we set out to do. At other times, things go horribly and we realize we should have listened to God all along. This is the effect of free will and are using it in a way that is not in harmony with God. So we find Balaam riding on his female donkey, headed towards Moab, accompanied by two assistants. Suddenly, God shows up in the form of the angel of Yehovah. And amazingly, Balaam doesn't see the angel of the Lord, but the donkey does. And now we learn something more about Balaam. He's spiritually blind. He has no visibility into the spiritual world. He'd like his clients to believe he has. He can't see the angel of the Lord standing in his path, blocking his way. His donkey sees the Lord. So he swerves off the road, down into the fields, afraid of this sword-wielding apparition. And the supposedly super-spiritual Balaam, well, he's utterly oblivious of the reason for his donkey's actions. So he beats the donkey to get her back up on the road. A few feet farther, the Lord stations himself on a very narrow spot on the road with a fence, meaning a wall of piled stones on each side. Afraid, the donkey tries to back away from the fearsome angel, and in doing so, catches Balaam's foot between her side and the stone wall. Balaam is no longer merely irritated, he's in pain. So he beats the donkey some more to get her to release his foot. A few more feet, the path becomes so narrow the donkey couldn't go around the angel of the Lord, so in self-defense, her knees buckled, she just went down. Right there on the spot. Balaam now lost his temper, and he began a terrible beating of his poor, frightened donkey that had done the only thing she could do under the circumstances. Animals behaving strangely were omens to even the most novice sorcerers. That Balaam completely ignored his animal's behavior is meant to show his complete determination to do what it is he set out to do. Disobey the Lord and get his hands on that money by cursing Israel. I suppose I could stop and tell you a couple of cute anecdotes about all this and what this means to us, but I don't think I need to, because right about now we're all thinking, whoa, how many times have I tried to go around or through the Lord? And it has brought me nothing but pain and grief. There's that misuse of our free will again. Still completely blind to what was actually going on, the Lord enables the donkey to speak. And the donkey asks Balaam why he's beating her. In other words, hey, stupid, can't you figure out something extraordinary is going on here? Have I ever behaved like this before? Haven't I been a good, faithful servant to you? And Balaam says, yeah, I guess you have to a point. Suddenly now that God has Balaam's attention by means of his talking donkey, Balaam sees this fearsome figure with the sword standing before him. And so Balaam drops to the ground just like his donkey did in panic. Blup. Now the shoe's on the other foot. The Lord asks Balaam why he keeps treating his donkey so badly. He points out that, in fact, if it weren't for the donkey doing the right thing, the Lord would have used that sword not on the donkey, but on Balaam. Okay, husbands and wives, parents and children, did you catch just what happened here? I told you last week that this was a Bible within a Bible in this story. Did one of you ever want something so much and the other one said no? You just knew that taking that new job, even though it meant moving away, or selling your house, even though your family was really happy where they were, or buying that new car, even though there's nothing really wrong with your old one, oh, that was just the right thing to do. But your spouse or your parent just wouldn't agree with it, and it nixed the whole thing. I'm not saying that the one who behaves as a roadblock is the one with good judgment. I'm saying that when something like this happens, maybe it would be wise to stop and take a little pause. Think about it. Stop and look for the Lord. Maybe it's just the reaction of a spouse or a parent that doesn't like change, or one who always wants to control the situation. Or maybe, just maybe, it's the Lord using that intransigent person to stop something he doesn't want done, but you're just blind to it. And he is trying to save you from either a terrible mistake that your runaway selfish desires just can't accept, or maybe you're being saved from his discipline. In verse 32, the Lord repeats that he finds what Balaam is doing in going to Balak as obnoxious. And Balaam replies, but he still doesn't get it. And he says, oh Lord, I was so wrong not to see you in the path. I was wrong to beat my donkey so terribly. I just don't know what came over me. But if you still disapprove of my going to Balak, okay, this time I won't go. Still disapprove? The Lord just told him that he found his going to Balak obnoxious. Balaam is pandering. He's doing the Texas two-step here. He's groveling. He's trying to manipulate. Gee, Lord, maybe it's not that you don't want me to get a new SUV. It's just you don't want me to get that new red Toyota SUV. Maybe blue would be better. That's it. You want me to have a blue one. Oh, maybe a Ford instead of a Toyota. I mean, this starts to really meddle with us, doesn't it? I don't like this too much. The Lord, the creator of free will, allows Balaam to exercise his free will. And so says, Balaam, you can continue on to Moab. But remember, don't say one thing to King Balak that I don't tell you to say. And Balaam is ecstatic at this. Boy, the money's there. Here we go. I know I can figure this out. And off he goes to meet King Balak. Let's read a little bit more. Let's start again at Numbers 22, verse 36, and go on to the end of the chapter. When Balak heard that Balaam had come, he went out to meet him in the city of Moab at the Arnon border in the farthest reaches of the territory. And Balak said to Balaam, I sent more than once to summon you. Why didn't you come to me? Didn't you think I'd pay you enough? And Balaam said to Balak, here, I've come to you, but I have no power of my own to say anything. The word that God puts in my mouth is what I'll say. Well, Balaam went to Balak, and when they arrived at Kiriath Huzot, Balak sacrificed cattle and sheep, then sent to Balaam and the princes with him. And in the morning, Balak took Balaam and brought him up to the high places of Baal. From there, he could see a portion of the people. Well, King Balak hears that Balaam is coming, and so he's anxious to get him going in his task of cursing Israel. So he travels to the northern border of Moab to greet Balaam. And as one of such regal importance would do, King Balak chides Balaam and wants to know why it took him so long to accept his offer. I mean, don't you believe I'll pay you? And Balaam, being cautious because of the donkey incident, says that while he is here, he really can't do anything now other than to speak what God tells him to speak. And King Balak is undeterred. He prepares a grand feast in honor of this sorcerer, and that's going to help him fend off these 3 million Israelites. Now, I want to point out that it was the ancient belief that if a seer and a diviner agreed to curse someone and did so, there's no question but that the curse was efficacious. Both the curser and the cursee believed it. So Balak's concern was not whether this curse was going to work, but rather would Balaam actually do it, considering, up to this point anyway, a pretty reluctant attitude. Now, no doubt the Middle Eastern mind of King Balak figured that this was all simply Balaam's way of upping the price. Well, after the proper protocol of wining and dining, this famous Mesopotamian magician, Balak escorts Balaam up into a high hill from which they could see some of the people of Israel as they were camping. And the place they went was called Bemot Baal. This means the altar or the high place of the god Baal. Now, they didn't do this out of curiosity just to get a gander at all those Hebrews. A curse was only effective when the cursed person or object was in view of the one doing the cursing. That's why it was necessary for Balaam to come to Moab in the first place, rather than just do it from Mesopotamia. Otherwise, Balak's emissaries could have simply loaded up with gold and silver, ventured up to Carchemish, where Balaam lived, and Balaam could have performed his ritual right from his front doorstep. Well, let's move on to chapter 23. We're just going to read the first 12 verses. Chapter 23 of Numbers, page 177. If you have a complete Jewish Bible. Balaam said to Balak, "Build me 7 altars here and prepare me 7 bulls and 7 rams." And Balak did as Balaam said, and then Balak and Balaam offered a bull and a ram on each altar. Balaam said to Balak, "Stand by your burnt offering while I go off. Maybe Adonai will come and meet me, and whatever he shows me, I'll tell you." He went off to a bare hill. God met Balaam, who said to him, "I prepared the 7 altars and offered a bull and a ram on each altar." And then Adonai put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, "Go back to Balak and speak as I tell you." He went back to him. And there, standing by his burnt offering, he, with all the princes of Moab, he made his pronouncement. "Balak, the king of Moab, brings me from Aram, from the eastern hills, saying, 'Come, curse Jacob for me. Come, denounce Israel. How am I to curse those whom God hasn't cursed? How am I to denounce those whom Adonai has not denounced? From the top of the rocks I see them. From the hills I behold them. Yes, a people that will dwell alone and not think itself one of the nations. Who has counted the dust of Jacob or numbered the ashes of Israel? May I die as the righteous die. May my end be like theirs.'" And Balak said to Balaam, "What have you done to me? To curse my enemies is why I brought you here, and you've totally blessed them." And he answered, "Mustn't I take care to say just what Adonai puts in my mouth?" The number 7, as a divine number of great significance, was neither the invention nor the sole province of Israel. It was a commonly held and used number in ritual throughout the known world. Listen to this short excerpt from a clay tablet found from the old Babylonian era, around Abraham's time. It says this: "At dawn, in the presence of Ea, Shamash, and Marduk," these are all Babylonian gods, "you must set up 7 altars, place 7 incense burners of cypress, and pour out the blood of 7 sheep." Ibn Ezra points out the number 7 is used often in the ritual calendar of the Hebrews. 7-day week, 7th-day Shabbat, 7th week, Shavuot, 7 years, sabbatical year, 7th month for a special biblical feast, 7 sprinklings of blood of the heifer towards the tabernacle, so on, so on, so on. And why wouldn't it be so that the number 7, as a cultic number of special significance, was common throughout the Middle East? The Lord God set down 7 as an important pattern from the time he created the heavens and the earth. that mankind had perverted their worship, had adopted false gods, had twisted and misused rituals, didn't mean they forgot everything that had been taught to Noah and then handed on down. They just used it as a foundation to fashion their own religions. So the ritual we find at the beginning of chapter 23 is what would be expected of a Mesopotamian sorcerer like Balaam. Seven bulls, seven rams, sacrificed on seven altars, just like we read from that ancient clay tablet. Well, after the animals had been slaughtered and their carcasses were burning on the altars, Balaam instructs King Balak to stand beside the altars as he goes to have a word with Yahweh God. And Balaam tells the Lord that he has sacrificed on the seven altars, and naturally the Lord doesn't reply because he certainly didn't instruct this to be done. Rather, the Lord ignores Balaam's attempt at appeasement, and he instructs Balaam as to what he's to go back and say to King Balak. And Balaam goes back to where the king was standing by the burnt offerings, where the king's court was standing dutifully alongside of him, and he pronounces what Balak thought he had been waiting for. In a nutshell, Balaam says that even though King Balak brought him here to curse Israel, no man can put a supernatural curse on that which God has blessed. As much as that must have infuriated the king of Moab, Balaam goes on to prophesy a glorious future for Israel. He basically restates God's promise to Abraham that the Hebrews will multiply into uncountable numbers. This is not what the king wanted to hear. But something else is also said that succinctly makes a point that we've discussed in this class on numerous occasions. There is Israel, and then there is everybody else. Or as it says in verse 9, yes, a people that will dwell alone or apart and not to be reckoned as among the nations. To review, what this says is that an Amim in Hebrew will dwell apart and not be reckoned as among the Goyim, Gentiles. Here we see that an important transition has been made. Israel is henceforth referred to biblically as God's people, His Amim. All other people on the planet, Gentiles, are called nations, Goyim. Goyim is no longer a word that just means nations in general. It now specifically means Gentiles or Gentile nations. It no longer includes the Hebrew people or the Hebrew nation. So here is a Gentile seer who's been instructed to make it clear to all mankind that Israel is entirely different from everybody else in God's eyes. Not better than Gentiles, distinct from Gentiles. Even the standard vocabulary of calling Israel a nation no longer applies. So separate does the Lord see His chosen from the rest of humanity. To cap it all off, Balaam says that it will be a blessing for him, and in essence for all mankind, if they can somehow find righteousness in the eyes of this Hebrew God and die in that knowledge of blessing. This was not quite what Balak expected to hear. And obviously frustrated, flabbergasted, he says to Balaam, "What have you done to me? I brought you here to curse my enemies, Israel, and you've like totally blessed them." And Balaam replies, "Well, I can only say what Yahweh tells me to say. I told you that when I arrived here." King Balak, of course, figures that the clever Balaam, he's just raising the ante on this deal. So he says to him, "Okay, I got an idea. Let's go to another hill. You can curse Israel from there. Maybe you can get it right this time. How about a little raise to go along with it? We'll pick up with this next time."
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a Purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.